you. So it is a privilege to be able to introduce Professor James Heckman. Jim has been at the Department of Economics at the University of Chicago on and off since 1973, and he won the Nobel Prize in Economics in the year 2000. Now, I would like, if one had to characterize Jim in a few words, I would say he's a serious scientist. I learned from him the sentence of Lord Kelvin, which is, there is no science without measurement. And Jim has been living up to that in all his scientific career. So what does that sentence mean? There's no science without measurement. Well, first it means there's no theory without data. So if you call yourself an economist, you have to go out there and collect the data and look at the data. And this is what Jim has been doing in his career, and this is now he is certainly one of the leading econometricians alive on this. But it also means something else. It will also mean there is no data without theory. The data, once collected, does not speak by itself. You need some theory to interpret the data. So what does economic theory tell you? Well, it tells you that people are not atoms lying passively around. People are active. They anticipate other reactions. They act according to their own interest. They will lie to you if they find their interest is in doing so. And Jim has taken that theory seriously, and he has set new standards in econometrics by devising methods whereby you can cut through all that strategic individual behavior and get to the really relevant parameters. And finally, Jim has been taking mathematics seriously. He knows that mathematics is not just adding and subtracting. It's not even number crunching. Mathematics is about structure. And Jim believes that by the mathematical structure of economic models, if you understand it and take it seriously, will bring you new economic insights. And that's what he's going to talk about. And Jim, thank you. And let me tell you that it's great working with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, I want to thank Ivar for a nice introduction, and I would say that I also enjoy working with him. And in fact, what I'm going to be talking about today is a project that I've been doing jointly with Ivar and a couple of other associates, some mathematicians and some economists. And I want to describe that work and try to motivate possibly widen the horizon of mathematicians about what golden opportunities arise in understanding economic models using the tools of mathematics and interesting mathematical challenges as well. I'm very pleased to be able to participate in this program and to admire not only the visual beauty of BAMF, but also to admire the program, the vision that has been clearly thought through and is very much documented in terms of the number of research seminars planned for the years 2003 and 2004. I think this is going to be a major center, and I wish it well, and I hope that its work is widely disseminated, because I think if I read correctly the lessons here, at least the program here, the wide-ranging set of topics of great interest to many people, not just mathematicians around the world. So what I want to talk about today is really three different topics. First of all, I want to talk a little bit about the role of mathematics in economics. Not much, but some. And also to talk about some practical issues that mathematicians face about funding. But that's not the main point of my talk. I really want to talk more about exactly the economics and mathematics of quality in a modern economy. But at least I want to motivate some of this problem as being an example of what I think is a fruitful symbiosis between mathematics and economics, and to suggest not only what has been achieved, but what the potentials are and what the remaining problems are, and some of them are substantial. But let me start with a quotation, which I think is probably going to be repeated in some form or another throughout the entire program today and into the evening. This motto from Gibbs, the famous physicist, appears actually on the title page of Paul Samuelson's classic work, Foundations of Economic Analysis. This book by Samuelson, written in the late 30s, early 40s, is a cornerstone of modern economic analysis. And I think this phrase is still relevant today. I think it's very clear, and especially I want to try to make clear today by some simple examples, that in fact mathematics is a language for clarifying ideas, terminology, and establishing relationships that are implicit but vague. The introduction of mathematical thinking into economics has had a huge impact on elevating the level of discussion, and I think the status of the field in the sense of really being able to draw on the tools of mathematics and to also pose interesting, challenging questions, and occasionally to do an interesting piece of mathematics as well. However, I should point out just in passing that the introduction of mathematical reasoning into economics was not always a welcome development. Someone as eminent as Lord Keynes was on record in the late 1930s as actually opposing the introduction of mathematical reasoning on a wide scale into economics. Keynes's fear was that it would lead to a group of inferior mathematicians doing second-rate work and being distracted from the essential economic problem. And so there's always this tension in any kind of applied field of saying, well, there's this statistics, or this is real statistics, or this is real biology, or this is real economics. And Keynes was actually on the side of saying, well, if we created all these second-rate mathematicians who really couldn't do original mathematics, what we do is kind of divert people into subsidiary categories and not focus on central problems of economics. Now, I think the record proves that Keynes was wrong on this point. The developments in mathematics have led to major developments in economics. So, for example, just to give a few examples, recursive methods, dynamic programming methods, Bellman equations, the whole apparatus of recursive economics, which has reformed the way we think about macroeconomics, finance, and dynamic general equilibrium models, has been a direct outgrowth of applications of formal mathematical methods. And in fact, the very transformation, the very book which has this as its center, in its introduction, was more or less outmoded, at least the second half of the book, by essentially the developments of dynamic developments in economics, in mathematics, which had direct application for understanding dynamic aspects of the economy and understanding how agents behave in dynamic environments under uncertainty. We also know that important developments in game theory, Nash equilibrium, the work of von Neumann-Morgenstern and successor work, and then, of course, large computer science and simulation methods have been extremely fruitful. So I think the track record really suggests that mathematics has been a cornucopia of knowledge for economics and a source of much practical information in many other fields as well. Now, we know that there's a major development here, and we know that, in fact, economists have used heavily these tools. But there's a real issue, and that is what's in it for mathematics. The traditional vision of mathematics, as I understand it, was one where, especially look at Hardy and Paglia and Littlewood, the idea was that any kind of practical applications were considered somewhat dirty and somewhat irrelevant to the main field. But I think it's true, at least if we look at the track record in the last 50 years, that the solution of practical problems has been a source of insights, a matter of great interest, and has been also, like it or not, a source of justification for support of mathematics. there has been, as many of you are well familiar, a view out there that science and math are being held accountable in many other fields. And in fact, there's a somewhat narrow vision even of a cost-benefit analysis. And we know it's extremely hard, actually, to conduct such cost-benefit analyses. It's very hard to measure the long-run benefits of knowledge. But for practical purposes, like it or not, a case has to be made. And I think it's very clear, again, like it or not, and I don't personally, that the idea of knowledge for knowledge's sake has become much less widely supported than it was 40 or 50 years ago. And so in some sense, the question is, what do we know? And this shows up, I think, in some real part. I brought one striking graph. I am an empirical economist, so I can't help but give you some data. But this is data that you might find interesting, since most of you are mathematicians. And that is the support, total research funding for mathematics. Now, this is in the United States. And you can see, this is now starting in 1956 and going through the year 2000, that you can see that the rise and fall of support for mathematics, the National Science Foundation budget, by the way, has been this sort of, it rises up to this point and then has been fairly stable from about 1968 to about the year 2000, with very few changes. And we can see that, not surprisingly, Sputnik, events associated with the war, have dominated a lot of the funding of research. Defense in mathematics and in defense, Air Force, Navy, have played a huge role. And so in some sense, this practical aspect of mathematics is, like it or not, a major component. Now, one could argue that mathematicians should try to wean themselves from this source, look for other sources of funding. That's not what I want to talk about today. But nonetheless, there is a sense in which a case has to be made, like it or not, and it's an unpleasant reality. But I think it's very easy to develop a case for support. And in fact, I think one can look very clearly at the track record in a number of fields, and I'm only offering one case study today. And so that's what I want to talk about today, is actually the case study of benefits of collaboration, my work with Ivar and others. And in fact, I think throughout my entire career, I've benefited greatly from the collaboration of mathematicians and the work of mathematical economists. So what I want to talk about for the rest of this talk is essentially the economics and mathematics of quality in a modern economy, and try to explain what I mean by that. Now, if we think about quality, quality and variety are central features of a modern economy. As wealth increases, technology improves. It's the quality of goods that increase, not mainly the quantity of goods, as society gets richer. The same is true of its labor force. As the scale and the level of technology increase, so does the possibility for comparative advantage and investment in specialized skills, which we know are a major source of improvement in modern economies. So any study of the modern economy has to be a study of heterogeneity and diversity. Now, the standard approach in economics, and in fact, indeed, the standard approach embodied in the very Samuelson book that carried that quote I put up, was basically to assume a uniform quality of a finite number of goods. But recent approaches have recognized that quality lies along a continuum. And this creates a large-scale demand for mathematical input to really understand how to model and think about quality. So what I want to talk about today is the economics of quality, which has been developed to try to have very practical purposes, but at the same time poses a number of very important mathematical challenges. The economics of quality was developed to understand such practical matters as things like consumer price indices, the understanding of wage inequality. If we recognize the sources of differences of wages, a big chunk of that difference has to do with the skills of individuals as well as the prices of those skills. To understand topics like how regulation and deregulation affect consumer welfare. But we know also that the tools, at least the traditional tools that have been used in economic analysis, have been very limited. And I want to give you an example of how a certain line of activity was limited, came into existence, posed formidable mathematical problems, work on it stagnated for 20, 25 years, and then suddenly progress is being made as we draw on a richer set of tools and develop mathematical tools appropriate to the task. And so now I want to talk about this work with Ivar, Lars Nesheim, and also Rosa Motzkin. So I want to talk about what economists have called hedonic analysis, the root being pleasure. But here, pleasure not just in the sense of Dionysian dances in the woods, but literally a pleasure in the sense of people demanding goods, supplying goods, but also providing some recognition of a variety of these goods and recognizing intrinsic features of a modern economy, which are heterogeneity and diversity. And so I want to talk about this problem and motivate it. And Ivar asked me to put this on, so I will, because in some real sense, you can't understand the rest of the talk unless you understand this motivation. This is exactly the slogan that's etched on the social science building at the University of Chicago. It's been there since 1974. And this is exactly the quote that Ivar was saying, The reason why I raise it is that this whole issue is really fundamentally a practical measurement problem. But to understand how to measure it requires very sharp mathematical thinking, much sharper thinking actually than was used when the initial problems were formulated. And so in some sense, the work is really an execution of this general research vision that we really do need to measure. And if you can't measure, if we don't make some contact with reality, we have some real danger of doing something very pretty but not very useful, and maybe intellectually satisfactory but not of direct use, and therefore maybe not making the case. But nonetheless, there is nonetheless the notion that these measurement questions pose severe and interesting mathematical questions. So I want to talk about some aspects of this measurement problem. So first of all, a key idea, and it's a very important idea, which was really developed in economics. Now, the word identification is used very differently in different branches of applied mathematics. And I want to give you a precise notion of what we mean by this. But a central concept of scientific measurement is identification. And the concept of identification literally means trying to ask, in what sense can we discriminate among alternative models from a given set of data? Now, the set of data itself may consist of things like sampling distributions, just raw numbers, or it could consist of something stylized, like probability distribution functions, which are free of any kind of estimation error. So I want to at least motivate the identification question, because it's the solution to the identification question that underlies a huge amount of controversy and scientific progress in economics. The idea is that we can go across in many fields in economics and understand that there are competing theories trying to explain the same data. And these competing theories have huge implications and differences in implications for how policy should proceed and how we actually interpret the phenomena in the world. And so the question is, can we use data? Can we use evidence to try to go back and understand which of these theories is appropriate? And in this context, the identification issue is a central problem. So let me just give you a very brief introduction to this and then consider a direct application of how we go about considering the identification problem. So what I want to consider is the question of identification, determining models from data, both hypothetical and actual. And what I want to consider is a very abstract notion of a model space M. And this model space M comes from some theory. There may be a whole series of competing theories. And we can imagine that any particular element in cap M is going to be one possible theoretical model. So we can imagine a world in which we have some space. How we construct this space is partly a matter of debate, but we're interested in this M, some elements in M, and trying to decide which one of those elements actually is describing what's going on in the real world. Now, if we think about this question, we can think that there are two attributes of any kind of theoretical model. The first is what one can observe about the model in a given set of data. And I want to emphasize that the word data here is used, can be used in multiple senses. So this is an abstract notion. It can be hypothetical, it can be actual. Hypothetical meaning, well, we can imagine an idealized sampling distribution which converges to some limit, or we can say, no, we only consider identification on actual distribution, some real samples, finite samples. So the question is that we have two features of a model: what the model says about the data, and what features of the model we're actually interested in. So it's useful, I think, analytically, to separate out two different functions here, two different mappings. One is essentially the model into some target space. These are objects that we're interested in or potentially interested in. And another mapping is going M into S with the source space. S stands here, if you want to think of it, for the data. And so S is the source space, T is the target space. And there's some parameters, say, associated with T. And we'd like to know which T imply which M, so which models are actually correct. So this is the idea. This is at a very general notion. So the idea of the abstraction that makes the difference between M and T is that some parameters may be of interest while others may not be. So for example, we may have very general models, but we may only be interested in a very specific subset of parameters of those models. If we're interested in production technologies, we don't need to build an entire general equilibrium model, or we can be somewhat ambiguous about the rest of the economy, but we do very much want to know something about how, say, capital substitutes with labor. However, we might want to know the whole model, in which case T is the same as M. So the real issue is that there are many models M that may be consistent with the same source space. And so what happens then is that this mapping H is not necessarily one-to-one. And so the whole element, let me just draw a picture instead of going through, it's a very elementary idea, but this really represents in one form or another an idealization of an entire line of activity, where we essentially have this mapping, this model space, taking us into data, and we want to get an inverse mapping and ask, can we go back from the source space and pick out a particular element in T or a particular element in M and uniquely identify it? So going back from the data to the original model. And that's the identification question. And economists have developed this idea for the last 100 years, but we're still in some real sense only in its infancy, only understanding how to deal with it in the most general way. In certain linear equation methods, this model is richly developed, but its development in a more general setting is still very much underway. And so there are various restrictions that one might impose to gain identification, and various properties of a model have to be developed. So here I want to ask the question, how can we identify a particular class of models? Well, so that's identification. I could be a little more precise, but let me just leave that as it is. Let me then consider the question of hedonic markets. The study of competitive hedonic markets is really central to economics. Two major scholars doing independent work developed this theory, but in very restrictive settings. My former colleague, the late Sherwin Rosen, the University of Chicago, who unfortunately died a couple of years ago, and some previous independent work, related work, I should say, by Jan Tinbergen, who actually was the winner of the first Nobel Prize in economics in 1969, sharing it with Frisch, established the framework for thinking about hedonic markets. So the question then becomes, what do we mean by these kinds of markets? What I want to consider then is just what the nature of the problem is, and what I want to try to understand and give you an example of is the following. That the hedonic model is generically nonlinear, and that this nonlinearity is a source of identification. Now, why do I go on about this? Well, we know that the most successful branch, in some sense, of applied mathematics is linear economics, this linear algebra and related developments. Simple to understand, relatively simple to compute, and a source of what much knowledge has been used in empirical work and in many fields, not just in economics. But unfortunately, in more interesting problems, and in particular the problem I'm talking about today, this linearity is very, very ambiguous. And in fact, turns out to be a source of misinformation, if you will. So the standard physicist's notion, which is to say, let's linearize around some point, or what taken over by many economists, has in this area been a source of actual confusion. And I want to try to show how thinking a little more sharply and using the tools of modern nonlinear analysis have actually aided developments in this field. But now, as most of you know, the word nonlinear itself is very, very ambiguous. It can mean many different things. So this is the third of three quotations I put up. And this is not suggested by Ivar, and I don't know if he approves. But this is this famous quote by Ulam, which is basically saying, calling something nonlinear is as vague as saying that most elephants in the zoo are non-elephants. And I think this is a great quote, actually. But it has multiple meanings, actually, in this context. Because in some real sense, the elephant is the biggest animal in the zoo, or most zoos. And maybe the giraffe's a little taller, but the elephant's bigger, and so forth. But the point is that the point is that the zoo has many other dwellings, and which cages are we going to? So what I want to talk about, actually, is, in fact, that most of the time, and in this literature, this linearity played a central role, but a certain type of nonlinearity, which I'll make precise in a minute, turns out to be essential to understanding, even defining the problem, and then coming up with concrete solutions and tangible progress on the field. So I want to talk about the rest of the zoo today, and in particular, certain cages which deal with the solution of a certain class of partial differential equations. But it's this sense here in which the work, the problem was formulated, but the progress was slow. So the economic model for which widely used linearization methods are used, so as viewed as approximations, turns out to be very implausible. Commonly used linearization strategies actually are producing identification problems. And in a series of papers, we consider models. I'll only give the most elementary version to transmit the spirit of what we're doing, to essentially communicate how, in fact, generically, again a term I'll define, will be identified from data in a single market, and in fact, certain kinds of barriers to this application and development of this literature turn out to be surmounted relatively easily using the tools of modern nonlinear mathematics. And let me just, I emphasize some problems, but let me give you the idea of the range of problems where these tools apply before I turn to a specific example. This identification analysis turns out to affect a huge range of practical problems. For example, if we look at work by James Murley's done more than 30 years ago, which plays a huge role in understanding how to devise incentive contracts, how to motivate the design of and structure of incentives in organizations and the like. In particular, his work was on looking at taxes when parts optimal tax behavior when pieces of the information were not known to the taxing authority. Monopoly pricing, work again by the same Sherwin Rosen, Michael Musa and Sherwin Rosen. Work on taxes and labor supply. Work on social interactions and sorting. These problems that I'm talking about today have applicability, the solutions have applicability to this wider class of problems. So now let me lay out briefly what the model is and where we've made some progress. So let me just turn directly to a model, give you a little bit of economics. I hope it's not more than you want to hear, but let's see. Let me lay out a very simple framework. And this is the most elementary form. I'll try to talk about the more general version, but it's one where I think we can state the problem very clearly. And here's where the hedonics comes in. So what we imagine is a world in which we have a preference function, U being standing for utility, if you want, where this is the utility of agents. And C is essentially going to be consumption of the agents. And Z is earnings. So we imagine a labor market in this setting. The methods are perfectly applicable to product markets, but let me focus on a labor market for specificity, and this, because this is widely used in this area. So what we imagine is that there's an attribute Z, say some ability, some acquired skill, that essentially is valued in the market. And firms are willing to pay a price P of Z. So P of Z is actually the earnings of the worker. Theta is essentially going to be what we think of as a preference parameter. And theta varies among individuals. So we have a utility function, U, indexed by this parameter theta, but theta will have a distribution. So theta is going to have a distribution, and we assume, say, that this density is going to be absolutely continuous with respect to the Lebesgue measure. So we just let this be a density F theta, okay? And we have A being some set of parameters that are common across people. So that's the notation. So what we imagine then is that agents are all trading in a common market, P of Z. And so we face a common set of prices, but of course different agents may supply different amounts of Z, and have different endowments and different decisions. And consumption basically consists of what you get from your capital income as well as what you get from your labor income. And so this is then the framework for preferences. And so this would then, except now Z is going to be defined on a continuum. And so what we're going to think of is Z is some productivity trait. And at this level, it could be a vector of traits, it could be a scalar. And so just think of it then as a set of productivity traits. And so the worker is basically just maximizing preferences, maximizing utility, and we get then first and second order conditions. And then if we go back, way back, at least at point-wise, to the Foundations book of Samuelson, we find that we get standard first order and second order conditions for what's called a regular optimum. We get a parallel problem on the other side of the market. Economists since Marshall, and actually even before, but certainly since Marshall, have worried a lot about the developments of demand and supply. And so we want to look not only at what workers are willing to supply to the market if they're paid a given price, but what firms are willing to, what firms demand. And so we imagine the simplest model, a competitive economy, in which we imagine the output of the firm is captured by some production function F. So the firm then hires worker of type Z, okay? Now suppose we have the simplest economy we can imagine, one worker, one firm economies. Firms differ in terms of their productivity, and then there may be some common parameters B. And then they pay the workers the wage PZ, it's a one worker firm, so this is the net profit. So then firms differ, and they face a competitive price PZ. And the question then is, what do their conditions look like? And they're parallel. Namely, we get first and second order conditions. These, in a regular optimum, we'll be able then to have use some implicit function theorem results and solve out for the model. Now, the crucial thing is the following. The P of Z has been taken as given. P of Z is basically taken as a parameter that's given. And now the real issue here is to try to determine how pricing is settled. So let me consider a simple case. There are a number of cases we can consider, and each of them has interesting mathematical possibilities. But let me consider the simplest case, and then, if time permits, go on to more general cases and some other phenomena, at least to illustrate the nature of the problem and the nature of the solution. So we have a density of theta, and we have a density of nu. This is on the preferences of workers, their willingness to supply Z, and this is the demand for Z. Some firms are better at using Z than others. So we have this thing here. And for technical reasons, I want to make sure that the dimension of theta is greater than or equal to the dimension of Z. Dimension of nu is greater than the dimension of Z. And it's easiest to think of just setting these inequalities to strict equalities, because that simplifies the mathematics and so forth. Now, the economics of this problem is really essential. To understand that what we need to determine in this model, we now have a model of an economy defined over a whole continuum. And what we need to be able to do is try to understand the missing ingredient, which I've taken as given, namely this pricing function. The theory of equilibrium really requires that we come up with a pricing of this vector of characteristics. And then we can then see how this would proceed. So under the conditions that I had before, under the assumption of an interior optimum, we can essentially invert from the Z, the PZ functions, and the B to solve out the vector nu and the vector theta from the firm side and from the worker side. And now we come up with a characterization of equilibrium. Any economist worth his salt will say we want to equate supply and demand. So what does supply and demand mean in this setting? Well, it means this on the continuum. Everything's been made nice and simple. We can allow bunching. We can allow lots of discontinuities. But let me consider the simplest case first. If we go back and substitute in for the density of V, just to take the Jacobian of transformation, we have the demand density, the supply density, and what we come up with then is this. For each PZ, for each price function, that it's a candidate price function, this is going to be the demand at this point nu in that space on the continuum. Now we're working in the space nu. Here the space theta. What will lead? So this is sort of, quote, the number, if you will, or sort of the density of people at this particular point in the space given Z, and this is the density at this particular point of space, demand and supply. So it's not too surprising, maybe, if you know any economics, to essentially say, well, what do you want? What you want to do is essentially equate supply and demand. And so what comes up then is a differential equation of exactly this form, where we want to say, yes, we want to equate demand and supply everywhere, pointwise, and we want to be able then to essentially find a solution for P of Z that essentially will give us an equilibrium. And in special case, where the demand on one side or the other is inelastic, we essentially end up with a classical Monge-Ampère equation. But we actually come up with a somewhat more general form of that equation. And now this by itself represented a formidable barrier to economics when the ideas were first introduced. These represent serious problems, not only computational problems, but also serious problems in the sense of even trying to understand what the economic sorting process looks like. Here we can sort of understand that firms and workers are sorting on some underlying continuum. But the question is, how can we actually make progress along these lines? Okay? And so a research frontier consists not only of looking at these computational aspects of this problem, but also trying to characterize this in the simple case that I gave and some more general cases that I'm really not going to discuss today. Now, let me give you a very simple example. It's mathematically simple, and it actually takes us into the linear world. But this is more than an example. This turns out to be actually a justification for what was done for about 25 years. So if I take a very special specification, I take a very special specification of preferences, where I assume then that preferences are quadratic. So if I have parameters, which essentially, here's the pricing function, here's the quadratic and Z pricing preference function, we get simple first-order conditions, at least writing these down, standard second-order conditions, and worker heterogeneity in this case is essentially variations among workers in terms of theta. A itself is a fixed parameter common across all workers. And so this gives us something that has some promise of being very simple. Let me put this to the side because I want to come back to it. And on the firm side, we get a parallel specification, linear, quadratic, first order condition, and the like. Now, why do I go through this example? Well, I go through this example for a very simple reason. First of all, the decision rules here are linear. In much of applied work, and much even theoretical work in economics and in other applied fields, for example, in sociology, many social sciences, and in many statistical areas still, are using some version of these linear models. So we get at least linear parts here, and over on the consumer side, a linear portion. But what about the pricing function? Well, if I adjoin to the assumption of linear preferences, Gaussian disturbance on productivity of the firm and on productivity and preferences of the worker, so I make a normality assumption here and a normality assumption on the firm side and a normality assumption here on the worker side, I end up with a very, very simple model, which actually turns out to explain what actually goes on in the real world and to understand something. It turns out that, not surprisingly really, if you check the solution to the equation, it's going to be quadratic. The pricing function is going to be quadratic, where you pick up the constants of integration from various entry and exit conditions in terms of underlying profits of firms and reservation wages of workers, reservation utilities. So what you get then is a nice linear problem, and in fact it turns out this is exactly the linear problem that more or less was used as a basis for approximation. But this provides an exact justification. Okay, so what does this problem tell us? Well, first of all, we have then linear technologies and the like, but we get certain conditions here. Let me just give you the essence of the condition. The condition essentially is to say that we're going to sort workers and firms. And let me just show you an example of that condition here. So if I think about this as the price, this is like some PZ. This is basically the derivative of the firm technology, partial pi with respect to Z, under this assumption. Okay? And so this looks very simple and linear, and it looks very traditional. In fact, this is more than just a nice little coincidence. This turns out to be more or less the state of the art for the last 20, 25 years on this problem. And it's something very interesting turns out in this case. Is this model identified from data in a single market? Remember I said that economists are very much interested in this question of going back from the data to try to understand the underlying model. Which model, which of any model? Can we recover the preferences of technology and technology and preferences from the original data? Well, it turned out that there was a widely used estimation method. In the same paper where Rosen developed some of these ideas, he also suggested a very simple method. The method essentially was to say, okay, we can estimate the price from the data. Knowing the price is not hard. You can go to the newspaper and look it up. And therefore, if we essentially go to the prices, there are some measurement questions there, but let me abstract from that. We're led to this kind of estimating situation, either for the worker, for the firm, or for the worker. We essentially have a technology where we have a price we can get, and this actually is the first order condition. Okay? And so if I just write down and say, okay, these are things in terms of measured characteristics Y that are associated with a firm, and these are measured characteristics associated with a worker, then we essentially get this kind of linear equation. But this equation, it turns out, in particular, this class of models is inherently non-identifiable. And this observation led to no work on this problem for the last 25 years. Because people noticed, I mean, it's a triviality to see why it's non-identifiable. Because if we say, oh, the prices are linear, and this technology is linear, then we can see by any procedure, just think of linear regression, just imagine a projection of this onto this, what are we going to recover when we do this projection? We're going to recover, this instead of this preference or technology parameter B, we're going to recover exactly pi hat 2. it's transparent, right? That if we imagine projecting this onto this, we're going to get this, because obviously it's going to reproduce itself. And exactly the same thing over here. So something is very strange. A equals B equals pi hat 2. And that led to an entire line of work saying, this model is very pretty, but it's very useless because it leads to crazy implications and you can't use it. And so now if you read in the literature, I don't think many of you want to read the literature, but if you do, I'll happy to give you the references, you'll see that this is viewed as a fatal flaw of the model. And how did this fatal flaw come about? And is it intrinsic to the model? And the answer is no, it's not. First of all, you'll notice the way this was actually presented was not writing down linear quadratic preferences and not writing down normal and non-normal models and so forth. What was done was actually saying, I'm going to linearize everything using the standard techniques, you know, borrowed from science or borrowed from somebody, and come off and say, I can get identification, and then say, oh, but look, I face this fatal problem, therefore I can't identify the model. Well, you can see. In fact, let me just give you a very striking example. It's easiest to see. So, in fact, the literature settled at this question. By the early 80s, after this literature had percolated around and been much discussed, there was a view that basically this whole class of models is basically arbitrary. It means that there can't be any empirical content. So many economists lost interest in it. It wasn't that they weren't pretty models, but they were models that essentially couldn't really be distinguished from the data. We couldn't learn much about preferences or technology. And so the view was, well, if I go back to that example, so if I just go back to those first-order conditions, it's a simple equation, and say, oh, suppose that this is linear, but this is nonlinear, well, in, say, adding a polynomial or some cosine function or something, then maybe I can break this problem. And there were some suggested papers. But the view was that this type of nonlinearity, this kind of perturbation, was viewed as arbitrary. Where did it come from? Was it intrinsic to this class of models? So the question becomes, how generic, if we think of this, embed this into a much wider class of models, how generic is this linearity and how generic is this non-identifiability? And this is exactly where I think the literature stood. And in fact, I think it stood this way as when Rosen died. Well, unfortunately, he went to his grave thinking this. In fact, he was very insistent that the model was somewhat useless for this point. So let me give you a striking example. This is just a numerical simulation, but it just shows you. Suppose I start off with a more precisely formulated benchmark model, not as a linearization, but asking what model actually justifies the linearization, which is this normal quadratic model. And then I say, suppose I perturb it in the most elementary way. So suppose, say, instead of having a normal for these unobservable nu and theta, suppose that I say, let it be a mixture of normals. And remember, the problem was that I had linear on linear. I couldn't identify anything. That was the nature of the problem. Let me show you a very striking example of how a small perturbation changes. Suppose that I take the same kind of equilibrium economy, entry conditions, zero profit conditions, all satisfied, and let me just give you a simulation of the derivative of the pricing function. This solid line is basically the pricing function that comes under the assumption of normality, which was sort of the implicit assumption in this literature. Now, if we take a perturbation, which essentially takes this and gives mass 0.999 and a little bit of perturbation of another normal component, but with it centered at a different mean, that the pricing function actually dramatically changes to something that's nonlinear. And what this means is that in this context, we can actually identify the model. So you ask yourself, well, wait a minute, that's very interesting. But again, that looks kind of arbitrary. I can give you lots of examples, but the point is that, in fact, this linearity and nonlinearity, you can come up with lots of examples, but what do we know? How generic are these? Well, I'm running out of time, so let me just talk about very briefly. There are other issues that arise here, but let me just give you some results and conclude and talk about the importance of this and where the frontier is. The point is that we can essentially establish then that if we think more broadly about the class of models and use some results from nonlinear mathematics, that we get generic identification. And then, in fact, the criticism that was placed into the economics literature as a central criticism essentially is irrelevant and, in fact, is basically a very negligible set of models. It just turned out to be the convenient model. It just turned out to be the linear model. and it just turned out to be the starting place and this resting place of virtually everyone. So the question then is, let me just show you and then just announce a result, because I don't have really time to establish it. Let me take the simplest case. We actually have a whole series of examples, but it's easiest to take this case here where we have a production technology which is additively separable in its components. So that what I imagine doing is, this is the same profit technology. I specialize it so that it's additively separable in terms of the characteristic, the unobservable. This is the unobservable here. This is the characteristic. This is the price. And we get a parallel decomposition on the firm side, on the consumer side, in terms of additive separability. This has subsequently been relaxed, but let me give you the first such result. The equilibrium sorting in this model is basically then going to be a sorting of different workers to different firms. So you can see why this is such an important model. If we think about sorting of children to schools and parents picking schools, what economists call Thiebaud equilibria, where neighborhoods are formed by agents sorting on basic characteristics, these same problems underlie exactly this question. So we get some kind of sorting, and that sorting is a major source of interest and difficulty. And in the class of this model, this is basically just going along and saying, yes, we have equilibrium, and equilibrium is, it's again, equating the supply density and the demand density. I'm going over this quickly. I don't intend to blow you aside here with this notation, but it's basically the same idea in a more precise setting. Now, what have we shown in this system? Well, just using what I think is a standard definition of genericity, this definition, we essentially establish the following result about this class of models. And this is the first of many results, but it opens up some new thinking. That generically, with respect to any, in this sense of genericity, with respect to any of the parameters of these underlying technologies, that basically this non-identification result, which stopped the entire literature, is basically doesn't hold. That property doesn't hold. So what had been a central feature when we embedded in a larger nonlinear model and allow for a richer class of solutions from that differential equation I put up, essentially becomes a very, very general, becomes turns out that identification is something very general, and that, in fact, all the criticism that stopped work in this area is now, I think, invalid. Well, this is only the most elementary version of this problem, and I've really come to the end of my time. Let me just talk very briefly about the kind of extensions that are underway. Certainly, the non-separable case has been developed and solved. Various dimensions here have taken the simplest cases. The most important new restriction, the most important new addition to this literature will be, instead of taking the assumption which has been made throughout much of this literature, mostly for mathematical convenience, of one worker matched with one firm, one customer matched with one product type, the idea of having multiple workers with multiple firms, having multiple product types, having allowing for bunching of workers and coalitions and the pricing of coalitions creates an interesting extension of this class of work. And we have some results on that. I won't have time to show those. But I think the general lesson is that this class of models now has opened up a wide range of interesting challenges mathematically. And the applications are legion. I mentioned that list of applications is huge, and I think the applications are promising. In addition, we also have the possibility of extending this line of work to consider much more general settings and dynamic frameworks with true human capital accumulation, true capital accumulation, and forms of uncertainty, so that we can address all these policy questions. So here's a practical example. It's an example of where relatively straightforward nonlinear mathematical methods, use of the Thom's transversal theorem, which Ivar was essential in using. The proof was essentially based on exactly this idea, was essentially allowed us to recognize the genericity of equilibrium and identification, which mean that this class of models has empirical content. And this has now opened up a line of research which I think is quite active and will continue. So I hope that this little exercise today, this lesson, this example, is an example which is gratifying to all of you mathematicians, about the power of mathematics and the great potential it holds. This line of work and the work it opens up, I think, will stimulate a huge line of activity It certainly, if mathematics is looking for practical justifications, this has got to be one of them. It certainly suggests there's a very wide class of problems of this type, measuring quality and equilibrium in infinite dimensional economies, which essentially promises to open up to many applied economists, many people, policymakers and the like, the power of the ability to think about quality in a modern economy in a precise and rigorous way, using the language of mathematics and the tools of nonlinear theory. Thank you very much.
It's always very interesting to see how in mathematics, quite often the first things we come across, which seem to be present one sort of problem and end up in one sort of place, end up in the end being something which is just a very small part of some much larger class, which turns out to be much more interesting and useful. So thank you very much for this. I think it would be very nice to spend time asking questions and having a chance to have some discussion, but I think in order to keep our program on track, we better forego that. So I hope that people will have a chance to talk to Professor Heckman at the end of this session if they want to talk to him more about it. I'd like to go on now to our second speaker, and Donald Sari, and I'm going to ask David Eisenbud to introduce him, but before he comes up here, I'd like to say something a little bit about David, because he indeed is one of the forces behind the existence of birds. This idea originated in the fertile mind of Nassif Kassoub, but he needed to find other fertile minds and people who had vision to help bring this thing into a place. And in fact, one of the very first people he contacted was David Eisenbud, who very enthusiastically joined in the idea of it, and has been, of course, the American participation in this has been an absolutely essential and very exciting part of it. So I'm very happy that David's here today and was able to introduce our next speaker for us. David, actually, I should mention, he's the director of MSRI, the sister institute here, and also he wears a second hat right now. He's the president of the American Mathematical Society. So, David.
Thank you.